Is it possible to heal by thought alone, without drugs, without surgery? Tonight, Dr. Joe Dispenza back on Coast to Coast as we talk about You Are the Placebo, Making Your Mind Matter, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Joe Dispenza back with us here on Coast to Coast. And he, of course, has been a main staple on the program. Last with me, of course, about a year and a half ago. He is studying biochemistry at Rutgers University. He now holds a Bachelor of Science degree with an emphasis in neuroscience. He received postgraduate training and continuing education in neurology, brain function, and he educates people about the functions of the human brain. He was with me when we talked about, of course, breaking the habit of being yourself. And Joe, I'm choking. Welcome to the show.
I'm very happy to be with you, George.
Tell me a little bit about your book.
Well, I wrote the book because I was intrigued by the idea that you can give someone a sugar pill or a saline injection or perform some type of sham surgery or fake procedure, and a certain percentage of those patients will actually accept, believe, and surrender to the thought that they're getting better, and they begin to produce their own pharmacy of chemicals that represents the inert substance or the procedure that they're about to undertake. So I wanted to know if I understood the science of how the placebo worked, and I could begin to demystify what science knows about it. Could we teach people how to do the same exact thing, but instead of putting their faith and belief in something outside of them, could they begin to believe in themselves? And when you understand the how, could you reproduce the same effects? And so I wrote the book because some of the research that we've done in our workshops around the world allowed us to see that that exact thing is possible, that people have the innate ability to heal themselves by thought alone.
How positive, Joe, do you have to be in order to create this healing effect?
Well, being positive is only a small percentage of it. Now, let's demystify that, because we think about 60 to 70,000 thoughts in one day. Out of those 60 to 70,000 thoughts that we think in one day, 90% of those thoughts are the same thoughts as the day before. So the same thoughts always lead to the same choices. The same choices always lead to the same behaviors. And the same behaviors create the same experiences, and those same experiences create the same emotions. And it's those same emotions that drive our very same thoughts. And our biology, our neurocircuitry, our chemistry, and even our genetic expression is really equal to how we think, how we act, and how we feel. So by the time we're 35 years old, if we're thinking the same thoughts, performing the same behaviors that create the same experiences, nerve cells that fire together wire together, and we begin to hardwire our brain into a very finite signature. That finite signature becomes our identity. And the experience that creates this familiar emotion that's related to the same exact thing you do every day begins to condition the body over time into a habit. And a habit is when your body becomes your mind. So 95% of who we are by the time we're 35 years old is a set of memorized behaviors and emotional reactions, beliefs and perceptions, and even attitudes that function subconsciously like a computer program. So now, a person's going to use 5% of their conscious mind to work against 95% of what they've memorized subconsciously. So a person can think positively all they want, but if they've memorized the state of negativity, that's mind and body in opposition. Or they could create a vision of their future and create a dream board with all the pictures of all the things they want to happen in their life. But if they feel unworthy, that's mind and body in opposition. So the process then requires more than just thinking positively, because if you're thinking positively but you've been feeling negatively for the last 35 years, you have a kind of a separation between a state of being. Why? Because thoughts are the language of the brain and feelings are the language of the body. And how you think and how you feel creates a state of being. So one of the elements then is not only thinking a positive thought, but it really is changing your state of being. And when you begin to change your state of being, what we're really doing is we're reconditioning the body to a new mind. And so in order for us to change those subconscious programs, then we have to get beyond that analytical mind, that part of us that separates the conscious mind from the subconscious mind. So in a placebo response, if you give someone a placebo for, say, for depression, they're given a placebo, and it's a trial for depression, and they're told they're given an antidepressant, that somewhere between 75% and 81% of those people will actually get the same results as if they've taken the actual medication.
Isn't that amazing?
So that's amazing, not only because the person actually gets better, but if you do a brain scan of a person over an eight-week period of time, you'll see physical changes in their brain. In other words, it's not only in their mind, it's in their brain. There's biological changes in executive function in the frontal lobe. Now, they couldn't consciously do that. In other words, we can't consciously say, okay, I want to increase serotonin levels. I want to begin to make my frontal lobe work better. There has to be a mechanism in which we accept, believe, and surrender to that procedure or to that medication or that placebo without analysis. And it's that process that begins to program the autonomic nervous system. And it's the autonomic nervous system that begins to make its own pharmacy of chemicals that matches the exact chemical of what we think we're taking. That's how powerful we are.
Well, are we saying here, Joe, that given the fact that you give somebody some medicine or you don't, if they think they're getting it, they're just as well off as if they were getting it?
In some cases, and not all cases, that's the case. In other words, in some cases, it requires more than just telling a patient. For example, if when you're working with something like pain, you can tell a person that they're receiving an analgesic or a medication that's going to reduce their pain. And just by telling them that, you can do a brain scan on those people. And if a certain percentage of people accept that thought, their brain begins to make about 200 times the amount of drugs, the morphine-like drugs, endorphins, that begin to produce their own pharmacy of chemicals. But it doesn't work if you tell a person this drug is going to increase your growth hormone levels. It tends to work a little differently with different conditions. And the other element that helps the placebo is this idea called conditioning. And conditioning has been around since Pavlov, where he took a dog and fed the dog a delicious meal. And at the time, just before he fed him the meal, he rang a bell. And if he kept exposing the dog to the meal and ringing the bell, over time, the conditioned stimulus of the bell caused the dog to salivate, and that caused its autonomic nervous system to begin to believe that the experience was about to happen. So in a lot of placebo studies, as an example, you can take a group of children that have asthma, and you can give them an inhalant that begins to reduce their asthmatic condition. And when they inhale that that medication, you couple it with vanilla. And in time, they're reducing the amount of the medication, and the child is beginning to associate the vanilla with the healing of their condition. And in time, they have dramatic changes in their asthma just by inhaling vanilla, because the autonomic nervous system, just like Pavlov's dogs, autonomically, subconsciously, begins to become activated to match the exact chemical you think they're taking. So it works differently for different things.
Joe, tell us about the study of the elderly men who were asked to pretend that they were 22 years old. What the heck happened there?
Well, there's a researcher named Ellen Langer who did a study. She's a Harvard University professor, and she took a group of eight men to a monastery north of Harvard. And the job was of these men was that they were to retreat from their life and pretend that they were 22 years younger. Now, when they arrived at the monastery, the environment was set up in a way that it reminded them of when they were 22 years younger. There was, newspaper articles and magazines with current affairs at the time. There were pictures of Marilyn Monroe and Mickey Mantle. There was Nat King Cole music and Tony Bennett playing. And all of their environment reminded them of being 22 years younger. And for the whole entire time, they had to maintain that state of being. Now, before they brought the men to the retreat, they measured some of their biological functions. They measured their finger lengths. They measured their toe lengths. They measured their eyesight. They measured their height. They measured their weight. They measured their bodily range of motion. And they even measured their cognitive ability. Now, at the end of 5 days, just 1 week, the men had longer fingers. They were actually taller. They had longer toes. Their toes straightened out. Less body fat. Their eyesight improved. They had greater range of motion. And their cognition, their mental ability, improved 63% on the average. Now, what does that mean? It means that just by pretending to be somebody else, there were significant biological changes that took place. So it begs the question, who are we pretending to be? Or better yet, who are we pretending not to be?
When all these placebo tests were done, was there anything shocking? Did researchers come back saying, wow, look at that?
Well, I think the idea of the placebo has been shocking people for a long time now. I just think that when people begin to embrace the idea that mind is that powerful, it opens the door, really, to possibility. So there's so many great stories of some great case histories. There was one in particular that really shocked the medical community, and it was done by Bruce Mosley in 1996 from Baylor College in Houston. He's an expert in orthopedic sports medicine, and he published a trial of 10 volunteers. They were military men that suffered osteoarthritis of the knee. And these men had measurable limps in their gait. They walked with a cane, or they had some type of assistance in order for them to ambulate. And so he decided to divide these men into three different categories. And he wanted to test the efficacy of arthroscopic surgery. So in the first group, he took two men, and he did the classic, what's called debridement surgery. It's a standard surgery where they open the knee up, and they begin to remove and scrape the cartilage out of the knee. Then he took, in the second group, three men, and he did what's called a lavage surgery, where they take high-pressure water, and they rinse and flush the joint and clear out the damaged cartilage. But then he took five men, and all he did was he made an incision on the side of the knee. They wheeled him into the operating room just like everybody else. They did the incision on the knee, but there was no scraping, there was no arthroscopic surgery, no removal of cartilage,
amazing,
no washing, and anything. At the end of the study, they started to notice that these men, up to 2 to 6 years later, were walking with no limitations in their leg, no pain, no suffering. They could perform all of their activities as they did before the surgery. In fact, the 10 patients that reported increased mobility and decreased pain, all 10 reported a change, and the people who didn't have the surgery, the five men who didn't have the surgery, reported the same changes, if not even better. So how do you explain how that occurred? In other words, those men couldn't consciously say to their knee, I want my cartilage to grow back, or I want my range of motion to change, or I want my pain levels drop. Somehow, they have to get beyond their conscious mind. And why does that occur? Because those men believed that doctors were the people that could do the healing. The operating room represents personal healing and change, and they began to become so conditioned that they accepted, believed, and surrendered to their healing without analysis. And that's the formula that begins the program, that automatic nervous system that generates the majority of our health.
What is it in the body, then? What is it in the mind, Joe, that creates this healing mechanism?
Well, there's two principles that really explain this better than anything else. And one in neuroscience is called neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity says that we're not hardwired to be a certain way for the rest of our lives, that we are marvels of adaptability and we're marvels of change. So every time we learn something new, we make a new physical change in our brain. Learning is making new synaptic connections. And so then, when a person begins to expect a different outcome, what they begin to do is they begin to envision a new possible future. When they begin to marry that kind of clear intention with hopefulness, or they begin to become excited about the outcome, it's that elevated emotion then that begins to change the body's physiology. Now let's talk about that, because the body is the unconscious mind, and it does not know the difference between the actual experience in your life that creates an emotion and an emotion that you can fabricate by thought alone. So when there's a clear intention, an elevated emotion, the body's beginning to believe it's in that future experience in the present moment. And for a certain percentage of people, that begins to reprogram the body's physiology. Now, why is that important? Because the second element that allows all of this to occur is a concept in biology called epigenetics. Epigenetics says that we're not doomed to be our genetic destiny, that the whole idea that genetics create disease is an absolute lie. Less than 5% of the people on the planet are born with genetic conditions like sickle cell anemia or type 1 diabetes or Tay-Sachs disease. The other 95%, those conditions are created by lifestyle and choices and stress. So then epigenetics means that there's a signal that happens outside the cell. Epi means above the gene. And it's that particular signal that begins to select certain patterns of genetic expression. Now, your body is a protein-producing machine. Muscle cells make muscle proteins. It's called actin and myosin. Skin cells make skin proteins called collagen and elastin. Your immune cells make immune proteins called antibodies. Your thyroid makes thyroid proteins called thyroxin. So your body is constantly elevating and making different proteins. So the expression of protein is the expression of life. So when the person begins to create that emotion, the body begins to believe that it's new information from a new experience, mm-hmm. and it begins to signal a new gene in a new way, and the body begins to make a new protein, and the expression of protein is the expression of life, which is equal to the health of the body. So by thought and elevated emotions, we're able to signal new genes in new ways to begin to reprogram our genetic destiny. We are our own biochemical engineers.
When someone is under stress, Joe, does that affect the ability to heal?
It's an absolute fact that all organisms in nature can tolerate short-term stress. The zebra gets chased by a lion. 15 minutes later, it goes back to grazing.
Right.
You're driving down the road. Somebody cuts you off. You have an emergency mode, you squirt out adrenaline. 20 minutes later, you forget about it and you keep driving. The problem with human beings is we can turn on the stress response just by thought alone. We can think about our problems. We can think about some future worst-case scenario and some past memory that's happened to us. And when we keep turning on the stress response and we can't turn it off, now we're headed for disease because the body cannot live in emergency mode for extended periods of time.
It breaks down, doesn't it? Joe, hold on. We're going to hit this break. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about your work. You are the placebo making your mind matter. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your calls next hour, your ability to heal yourself with your mind, and much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dr. Joe Dispenza with us. We're talking about his work, You Are the Placebo. Joe, so the stress mechanism literally shuts down the body, doesn't it?
Yeah, so stress is when your body's knocked out of homeostasis. The stress response is what your body innately does to return itself back to order. We have three types of stress. We have physical stress like accidents, injuries, traumas. We have chemical stress like bacteria and viruses and blood sugar levels and heavy metals and food and hangovers. Then we have emotional stress. That's family tragedies, second mortgages, single parenting, traffic jams, internet connections. And each one of these things knocks the brain and body out of balance. So when you interpret a threat in your external environment, you mobilize enormous amounts of energy, prepare yourself for that threat. And so when the threat is over, the body normally returns back to balance. And I was saying the problem with human beings is we can begin to turn on that stress response just by thought alone. And when we turn on the stress response and we can't turn it off, now we're headed for a disease because no organism can live in emergency mode for an extended period of time. So if all of the energy is going for some threat in your external environment, there's very little energy in your internal environment for growth and repair. So it's a scientific fact that the hormones of stress dysregulate and downregulate genes that create disease. So if you can turn on the stress response just by thought alone, and those chemicals make you sick, then by very nature, your thoughts can make you sick. So the question is, if your thoughts can make you sick, is it possible that your thoughts can make you well?
Does the voodoo effect explain how things happen to you as well? Hexing people, things like that.
Well, there's a great story that I put in my book about the voodoo curse. In 1938, a 60-year-old man lost 50 pounds, and he was living in rural Tennessee. And he lost all this weight over a four-month period of time. When they examined him, they thought he had tuberculosis or he had cancer or he had some type of disease. And all his tests came back normal. But he could barely talk. He couldn't eat. And he kept repeating that he was going to die. And so the patient's wife grabbed the doctor and told her that he had been voodooed by a witch doctor. So he lived in a community where that type of voodooing was common practice. And so he got in an argument with the local voodoo priest in a cemetery.
Not a smart idea.
Not at night either. And the priest waved a bottle over him of some poor-smelling liquid in front of the patient's face, telling him that he was putting a hex on him and he would die. Now, within a short amount of time, the patient thought that he had been hexed, and of course, he began to feel ill. So the doctor, when he heard the news from his wife, realized that he was going to perform something unorthodox. So he called the patient's family to the bedside. He said to everybody, "I think I know how to cure the patient here." And he said, he spun this tale, and he said on the previous night that he went and met the voodoo priest in a meeting at the cemetery, and he forced him against the tree, and he pinned him against the tree and choked him, and he asked the voodoo doctor to tell him what he had done. And the voodoo doctor said that he had rubbed lizard eggs into to the patient's skin, and some of those eggs made its way into his stomach and hatched. Now, most of the lizards died, but one of them actually survived, and a large one had hatched and it was in his stomach. And this is what he told the patient and his family. And he said, "And that little lizard is eating from you from the inside out." So then the doctor had took a big needle, and when he took the needle out, he told him that he was going to give him a special medication that was going to kill
the lizard.
And so he injects him with the medication that causes the patient to vomit. So now, the moment the patient begins to vomit, they have a basin for him, and now he's vomiting in the basin. And ceremoniously, as the patient is vomiting, the doctor comes in with a small lizard and pulls it out of the basin. And no kidding, in a very short amount of time, this is a true story, the patient opens his eyes really bright, sees the lizard, passes out in shock, falls asleep for 12 hours,
wow,
and wakes up in the morning and is completely normal, has a normal appetite, and within a very short amount of time, returns to his normal weight and his normal health.
What now, a great story.
It's because of culture that we're conditioned into accepting that. So is it possible when a person is given a diagnosis that they accept the voodoo curse as well? Maybe the modern-day witch doctor wears a white lab coat and a stethoscope, and when we're given a certain diagnosis about anything from diabetes to cancer, that if we accept, believe, and surrender because the doctor is the position of authority, just like the voodoo doctor, we begin to take on the very symptoms of that disease. So if a person then is given a diagnosis and they don't accept, believe, and surrender to that diagnosis without any analysis, there's a possibility that they're going to step outside of the conventional model, and there's an opportunity to have a hand in the level of health that they can create for themselves.
Joe, how do you explain a hex when the person may not know he's been hexed, but it still seems to work?
Well, it's still part of the culture because the person who's hexed and doesn't know he's hexed on some level has to believe on some level that he can be affected by that process. And so if it's a hex that produces some effect on him and he's unknown to it, then that particular priest or that particular voodoo person has some energetic effect that really begins to produce ripples in an invisible field called the quantum field. But that person still has to be willing to accept that it's possible.
Explain the difference between a double-blind study and a triple-blind.
Well, a double-blind study, I mean, the blind studies came about because there was a World War II Harvard-educated American surgeon called Henry Beecher, and he was performing surgeries on the battlefield, and at a certain point, he ran out of morphine, and he had to continue his surgeries, but he decided the only way that he could do it is if he was going to do a saline injection and tell the particular subjects that he was going to give them an anesthesia. And he performed several surgeries without any of the men going into shock. And he was the man that started the whole idea of the placebo. And he published some articles in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1955. And after that, we had to begin to do randomized double-blind studies, which means that the patient doesn't know that they're given a placebo, and the doctor doesn't know who's getting the placebo. So that's called a double-blind study. Now, a randomized triple-blind study is when the doctor doesn't know, the patient doesn't know, and even the statistician who's evaluating the results has no idea who's gotten the actual placebo.
Who does know? Somebody's got to know, right?
Well, yeah, it's all recorded as numbers, and then when it's exposed at the end, they can look at the results.
Yet that seems to work, again.
Because the mind is that powerful. If the doctor knows, he or she may influence the study because of even nonverbal cues.
Joe, the brain, of course, is a major factor in all of this, is it not?
Yeah, the brain is one of the key elements that starts this whole process. If you want to talk about really the effects of how this takes place neurologically in the brain, we have to begin to look at our ability to accept outcomes or expect outcomes. So most people, when they're living their normal life, they wake up every morning, they get out of bed on the same side, they brush their teeth the same way, they shower the same way, they drink coffee out of their favorite mug, they drive to work the same way. They get to work, they do the things that they can memorize and do so well. They see the same people that push the same emotional buttons. And they pretty much, every single day, it's their environment, their external environment, that's causing them to think certain ways. So the result of that over time is that the brain stays exactly the same. And if the brain stays exactly the same and you're thinking the same way, there's nothing that can change biologically for you. So for most people, it takes crisis or disease or diagnosis or loss when all of a sudden they start to wake up and they begin to look at how they're being. They begin to pay attention to their thoughts. Now, that process in neuroscience is called metacognition. Because of the size of the frontal lobe, we can think about what we're thinking about. We can pay attention to how we're behaving. and we can really become aware of how we're feeling. And that process of self-observation, self-correction, allows us to do a better job in life. So if we're going to talk about personal change then we have to begin to look at how we're going to go from the old self to the new self. And that process requires becoming conscious of the unconscious aspects of ourselves. When we begin to look at who we've been and the thoughts that have been falling behind the scenes of our awareness, and our unconscious habits and the emotions that have become so familiar to us, we begin to objectify our subjective mind, and we're beginning to no longer be that automatic program. So using the brain in the process of change requires, number one, becoming aware. And so in the work that we do and the research that we've done, we now know that we can use a model of meditation. And the purpose of meditation is to get beyond the analytical mind, to get beyond that critical mind that separates the conscious mind from the subconscious mind. And when people begin to learn how to regulate their internal states and change their brainwave patterns, that process is a skill, just like golf or tennis. And the more you do it, the better you get at it. And so in order for you to change something about yourself, the first step is becoming aware. And then as you begin to become aware, that process of inhibition means then you have to decide who you no longer want to be and then begin to decide who you do want to be. And that we call that crossing the river of change, because that's the moment now where you're going to begin to no longer think the same way or act the same way or create the same emotions, and it's going to feel uncomfortable. And that discomfort is because you're no longer the same self. Now, most people, when they step into the river of change and they feel uncomfortable, the hardest part about change is not making the same choice as we did the day before. So the moment we step into that river and we feel uncomfortable, it feels unknown, it feels unfamiliar, most people begin to make the same choices that lead to the same behaviors, that create the same experiences, that produce the same emotions, and they say, this feels right. Well, no. It feels familiar. The process of change, when you step into that river, that void, that unknown, is the perfect place to create from. That is the biological, the neurological, the chemical, and even genetic death of the old self. So people will say, well, I'm in the unknown. I don't know how to predict my future. I can't predict my future. Well, the best way to predict your future is to create it. So by the same means, as we begin to think about a new way of being, the process of speculation, when we begin to envision a new way of being, begins to organize the brain into new sequences and new patterns and new combinations. And as you remind yourself of who you want to be, nerve cells that fire together wire together, and you begin to install the neurological circuits so that the brain looks like the experience has already happened. Now, if the internal experience becomes real to the person, the end product of that experience is called an emotion, and now the body is getting a taste of the future. And if you can do that enough times, that programming process literally changes your biology, and you move from the old self to the new self. And we have seen people in our work heal themselves of cancer. We've seen them heal themselves of all kinds of genetic conditions that medical science had no solution for, because they fundamentally changed their state of being.
Joe, if you picture something, whether you picture a cancer tumor in your body or anything, maybe a new job, and just picture it, visualize it, does the body like healing? Does it take over and try to accomplish and get these things done?
Well, it depends. I mean, we've seen that it's not so important for a person to really visualize their tumor shrinking. That works really well with children, but it doesn't work as well with adults.
How come?
Because for the most part, most adults live in the past. You know, your brain is organized to be a reflection of your environment. It's an artifact from the past. All the things you learned and experienced are etched in this three-dimensional tapestry of your gray matter. And feelings and emotions are the end product of past experiences. And it's the emotions from past events that we begin to carry on for an extended period of time. And that emotion then keeps the same gene turned on and other genes turned off. So with most people, they've had events that branded them emotionally, and they're living by the same emotion, and there's no new information. And it's the redundancy of that emotion that over time begins to activate the gene to create disease. So if your personality creates your personal reality, and that's the model that we use in terms of change, and your personality is made up of how you think, how you act, and how you feel, then if a person really can change their personality and change their state of being, and they do that properly by rewiring their brain and emotionally conditioning their body to a new mind, then if they truly change their personality, then the disease exists in the old personality, no longer in the new personality, and they don't have to visualize the tumor going away. They just literally have to become somebody else. And we've seen this over and over again with all kinds of conditions, from MS to lupus to chronic pain to Hashimoto's syndrome. It requires then the person unmemorizing emotions that keep them anchored to the past and literally creating an emotion that drives them to the future.
What has been for you the most dramatic outcome of this that you've either witnessed or know about, where somebody just changed something dramatically?
Well, I've been brought to tears in some of the... We had a woman who was in Amsterdam just recently. I just got back. She's a mother of a couple children, and she was in the shower on a Sunday morning, and her husband said goodbye to her children, and then he left without saying goodbye to her, went to the tallest building in Amsterdam and jumped off the building and committed suicide. Now, that's a stressful event, and that stressful event knocked her out of balance, and she was angry and resentful and victimized and suffering. And every time she thought about the event, she produced the same chemistry in her brain and body as if the event was happening. And over time, it was those emotions then that began to signal the wrong genes in the wrong way. In a short amount of time, she developed a very serious neuritis. She was paralyzed from the waist down. She couldn't move. That was what the stress did. In a very short amount of time after that, she developed ulcerations in all of her mucous membranes, her throat, her esophagus, her vagina, her anus, her bladder. And now she had no job, she couldn't take care of her kids, she had no money, and now she can't eat, and now more stress is adding up.
So everything's falling apart.
Then she develops esophageal cancer.
Oh, jeez.
And now she comes and she starts doing the work, and she comes to our workshops, and she realized that it was the emotions of stress that turned this disease on. And she begins the process of change, and every day she goes and she practices her meditations and begins to signal new genes in new ways. And in a very short amount of time, all of her cancer is gone, all the lesions are gone, and she has no pain, and she's got a new husband and a new life, and she really went from an old person to a new person, and the disease existed in the old person. She's somebody else now.
It's amazing. Joe, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment, and let's take some phone calls for you as we talk about the ability to really not just heal, but do all kinds of things. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And don't forget to pick up our free apps for your iPhone and for your Android phone by simply going to coasttocoastam.com and click the store. I'm George Norrie, and we will be back with Dr. Joe Dispenza as we talk about his work, You Are the Placebo, on Coast to Coast AM.